Welcome to Adopting Zero Trust, an independent podcast. Our hosts, Elliot Volkman and Neil Dennis, will have transparent and open conversations with the people driving modern security approaches forward, while leaving vendor hype behind. It's time to remove implicit trust and buzzwords and get to the root of the movement.
Hello and welcome back to Adopting Zero Trust or AZT. I am Elliot, your producer, alongside Neil, your host, and today, I will not lie, I am really jazzed up and hyped up about this, not just because of where our guest comes from, and it is a thing that I use on the daily, including for our podcast, but because of how he has positioned and put some perspective around the concept of zero trust. If you are familiar at all with how organizations have built strategies and concepts around zero trust, it is a little drawn out, to say the least. There, in the last week, CISA announced an entire new zero trust office that they're putting together. There's books around it, and it just looks like years upon years to be able to achieve something. And is that really like the way that we want to position things if it is absolutely crucial and critical? So that is all to say, today we're going to be discussing zero trust in an MVP or, a most viable security perspective. We'll figure out that. I'll hand that off to the guest to be able to actually communicate that. So without further ado, Kane, if you could introduce yourselves and give maybe a little bit of background, and then we'll go from there.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm Kane. As Elliot said, I think he likes it because I live in New Zealand. And so I think there's going to be some Lord of the Rings trivia that might come up in this podcast as well. We'll see how that goes. Currently, I'm working at Canva. So for those who don't know, design company that does presentations, docs, that kind of thing. And we're currently in the process of building out Zero Trust there. My experience with Zero Trust has been building it at Shopify, at Atlassian, and a few smaller consultancies and startups along the time. And so the idea is that, yeah, maybe I take a slightly less traditional approach than what you would see in many places and build sort of, I don't want to say hacky, but build the minimum thing that you need to get the biggest security bang for your buck as soon as you can, basically. So rather than spending 2-3 years doing the planning, actually having something in place within 6 to 12 months and then iterating, building, and taking more of a builder approach than this sort of architecture approach.
Absolutely. So you nailed it. That is exactly what I hear. And it's not just because your amazing beard, and yes, the New Zealand thing is cool too, but that is the focal point. And of course, as per usual, Neil will take you down some other rabbit hole, I'm sure, and we'll probably ask you for 30 other return visits back to the show. But that is absolutely crucial because it is not really something that people have communicated effectively of how to develop this in a way where you can attack something, show impact and value, which in cybersecurity is always treated as like a cost center and you got to do more with less and all that good stuff. In George Finney's book, Project Zero Trust, it talks about that to an extent, but it still talks about a much longer cycle. And it sounds like from your perspective that you're able to attack one strategic thing, show impact, and then maybe expand from there. But I'd love to maybe expand upon that a little bit. What does that look like for you outside of maybe some kind of hacky things? Like, is it based on impact? What's the outcome that you're looking for with this philosophy?
It's a good question. I think it really depends on the organization, but I always start these projects out by sort of bucketing your applications into sort of risk tiers when thinking, does this have any sensitive data? And what that means to different companies will be very different. An approach I personally like is splitting down your data into user-generated content, PII, and splitting that into internal and external PII. And then you really dive down into where is our most sensitive data stored. And then from that, you take another layer above that and you go, what control access to our most sensitive data? So for example, Microsoft Intune, MDM, might not store any data, but it is certainly going to control access to your machines, and then your machines are going to then access your data stores. And so you need to think maybe one, maybe two steps back. But I do think taking that risk-based approach and working out what you care about the most and then focusing on that stuff. And so the way I normally recommend zero trust is it is a cake. You can cut it into as many slices as you want. It's going to depend on how big and complex the company is and that kind of thing. But I always recommend that the first sort of slice that you cut is protecting your most critical application and making sure that you can only access them from legitimate corporate-owned devices. Because the idea is that you probably don't want people accessing AWS, GCP, your customer data, with their personal mobile phones. And we've seen all sorts of breaches where like a Plex server got breached in one company, and then they pivoted Plex server to work account, and then from there into the corporate like network. And so I always find just you're better off protecting those things as soon as you can, and then worrying about the other stuff later, than spending 3 years without protecting a single thing.
Interesting. So are you more or less using your, I don't know, let's call it risk register to help prioritize where you would attack this? Or is it more specifically those examples that you highlighted are like, these are typically like the lowest hanging fruit that we need to attack and cover, or is it more internalized and prioritized in another format?
I think the risk register is your source, like it's where you start. It won't always be what you use. And the reason for that is sort of, you need to also consider usability as well as security when you're doing this. So for example, maybe I've got really sensitive customer data and it's stored in Zendesk for customer support or something like that. But maybe customer support agents need to be able to access things from their mobile in order to test customer queries. And so you may not have corporate mobile devices at that point. You might only have personal devices. And so you might say, this is super critical. We definitely do want to protect it, but we can't do it now. And so you need to make those trade-offs almost. And so then you might say, okay, I'm going to create my own standard underneath of the sort of risk register of the company. I'm going to have deviations from that standard, and I'm going to explain those deviations as to why. And then you may come back to those in later iterations where you start to clean up some of the prior things that you've left as exceptions.
All right, Neil, I'm going to hand this off to you. I feel like this is your world now.
Yeah. So I buckets in my brain are spinning a little bit. So from a terms background real quick for you, Kate, I come from an Intel background. So I tend to work a lot with, in theory, with requirements in a perfect world. So you talk about the risk register. I'm going to go backwards here with some of the stuff you mentioned. So you talk about the risk register. So for those in a normal world, risk register, I think, is more or less a roundabout way to talk about the overall risk profile that hopefully the C-suite and everybody bought into, right? So in my world, that translates into requirements for protection. In zero trust world, that also loosely maps out, in theory, the similar aspects of where we should be going. And I think real quick key takeaway is, and the whole goal of this larger conversation today is, bite-sized chunks make large impacts the more you do, like the quicker you're able to get to those pieces, right? So like you mentioned, a little bit of a pie section. Take a little piece, figure out what's hypercritical. Don't try to build a massive plan around the entire architecture. Try to figure out how to build a plan around that one little snippet, and then you can get to the rest of it as you move forward, at least proof of value. So with that, I think some of the things for me personally, these baby steps, what's your personal approach then? Where what we've seen, and what I think, LA, the reason one and you on this call, where we have most people take a 3-year program, 2-year program approach to things, and they don't start doing anything, right? So let's say if you're trying to push for value, or you're trying to push for funding, or whatever it is, you want to do something, but you don't obviously want it to be 3 years out before you're able to start implementation. How would you coach someone to approach this to say, hey, give me $100,000 for this, even though I know I need $10 million for this later, but let's get the money today for this one little piece? What's the risk kind of conversation balance look like in your mind?
It's a good question, right? And this is actually something I see in a lot of zero trust rollouts where they start and then they lose steam maybe halfway because either they were stacked up with contractors or they got people in from IT and developers, and then those people then have other priorities that are maybe higher, and they move off back to their original teams, and you get this sort of engine that was moving really fast and it slows down as time goes on. And so I think there are two approaches that could work depending on the company. I think you can absolutely set the 3-year plan. I think that you just need to have deliverable stages where you're being like, yes, we're going to do this then and this then and this then. And you can say, look, in 3 years, we're going to have a zero trust network or architecture that is at this standard. And I'll probably talk about this a little bit later, but I always recommend aligning yourself to some sort of framework or standard. So, you know, let's say we pick NIST and we say, hey, we're going to be like level 3 on the NIST zero trust standard. in 3 years will be at 5. And so that's one approach, and that's the sort of more plan everything first, then get going, but don't plan too much. Makes sense. I think the other approach you can do is you can just say, hey, we're going to protect this stuff. Like, we're going to protect our most critical applications. Once we have completed that, we will then reevaluate and see if going beyond actually makes sense for the company, because some startups heavy in the BYOD space, they might have more flexible requirements. They may not even have the need to actually build security to full zero trust standards where you have this data and context access and all that stuff. Like, just might not be worth the time. And so that's the other approach. So chunking it into those groups, having very set deliverables each time, and then re-going back for funding the next time.
So I think on that note, the microization of your requirements and your effort. So let's get back to the illusion of 3-4 year programs for rollouts, but you want to show value prop now. And this leads into a different question about scale of economics. Obviously, if you're a massive company with 100 employees all working on zero trust modeling and rollout, you just do it. But if you're a smaller company or a normal company, where it's the one person that's getting asked to do stuff for the sake of that guy keeping his job next year, I think your mentality and the approach of, let's just focus on one key thing, we'll build that, and then we'll build policy to fit the rest of things as we go. Because the construct is all still at the core the same, right? So if you do it around critical infrastructure, you're already building policy that you can apply towards these other endeavors downstream, in theory, at least fundamentals, right? It's just flipping what you're trying to protect and how you're rolling it out. So I think for most people, understanding bite-sized chunks is the best approach. Don't try to do it all in one large plan if it's literally just you doing it.
Absolutely. And I'm not an advocate of doing no planning and just jumping in and going, hey, we'll probably work it out. I think the granularity is the difference. I might build a project and I might say, we're going to build public key infrastructure and we're going to support all of our devices and we're going to build access criteria for them. And you find a lot of people will go too granular with it, though. They won't be happy with, we're going to have a project to build PKI. They just want to know everything now. They're going to want to know, but how long do the certificates live and how are we going to do revocation and will it connect up to all of our MDMs and stuff like that. And I think you just need to accept that, yes, these things will probably work. You'll probably get through it. You may have to do more work than you expected sometimes. You may have problems with vendors where they don't support the thing you need and you might push them early to get them to start building things. But if you get too into the weeds, you like you say, you just spend too long planning. And by then, some new tool will have come out. You will have released some stuff internally. And then that's more stuff you've got to add into the plan. And then you just end up planning forever, right?
I like that one. We had a wonderful quick chat about technology on LinkedIn, but who's really at fault? But that being said, I'm not going to repeat my quote from LinkedIn here.
I will if you want.
Yeah.
I built an entire website to troll those people. I think it was like topzerotrust.com. If you click it, it's Zero Trust EDR or SIM or whatever you go to. It's not actually a product.
Smoke. Tangent incoming, Kane. Here we go.
Go ahead. I'm interested to hear because I think I missed this one.
Elliot loves to troll the trolls, basically. We've got these, like you're aware of, having done this countless times now. You go out and you start looking for, it doesn't have to be just zero trust. Start looking for a solution because it's the latest flavor, like LLM and AI right now and ChatGPT related stuff. Magically, every vendor that's a top security performer magically has something in their marketing slick sheets that says LLM, APT, or API. They're APT-ish wannabe, but flavor of the day stuff, right? But it's all bull crap most of the times. It's just them repackaging old things and slapping a label on it. So it has built a wonderful site and interactions around those types of engagements. And let's get you the single pane of glass API LLM model for your EDR solution that does zero trust out of the box. Things like that being said, interactions on LinkedIn, having to deal with that. I'm going to ask you a question at the end of this, but I'm going to get to the point. Tech stack, to be fair to the ones who do actually have a legit solution, because there are obviously those that are out there. They come out of they say, hey, there's a lot of zero trust startup companies. There's a lot of companies that have hardcore folks on zero trust. And one of the mentions on LinkedIn was, I don't remember exactly what he said, but I remember what I said to say it was, Elliot's trying to show that it's not really necessarily the tech. it's maybe where we do with the tech. He was like, well, it's always the tech problem. It's whatever. And I commented back to some extent, to some effect, that it's probably not necessarily the tech so much as how you're implementing the tech that really makes it suck. It's like selling you a Brillo pad and you using it for toilet paper. It's not my fault what you get in the end. And so that being said, your experiences on this journey. So you've done this a few times and probably enough where at least at the beginning, there wasn't necessarily the marketing hype probably around the term. So you might've been looking at some of the basics, maybe from the Foresters and stuff like that, right? For the original terms. So I'm curious on this. What's your experience within the market space for what you've had to deal with from building something more holistic within your own world versus being able to actually go out there and procure a technology that said zero trust and you really being able to follow implementation plan based off of what they suggested and getting what you expected?
Yeah, that's a great question. To take you back to where I started, maybe 10 years ago now, I was doing security for the UK government and we were building zero trust then. Like it looked very different. Like we did have VPNs and some of that stuff. So technically it wasn't zero trust as we know it today. We had certificates on our machines. We were accessing the VPN with the certificates. We were doing posture checks on our devices. We had segmentation on our network and all of this stuff. And could you say we had a zero trust network? I think no, because the target has moved. And the idea of zero trust now is like a SaaS first. Well, unless you believe this sort of SASE stuff. Like to me, SASE is, it's like a place on the way to zero trust. And you may stay there. You may never get to zero trust entirely. Like you might stop there and just go, hey, this is good enough for us. Not everyone has to do zero trust. That's totally fine. Just accept it and maybe don't complete zero trust, I think. But so yeah, to get back into your thing, yeah, like when I started this, just there were no vendors at all. I think Google had just released their white paper on how they built BeyondCorp. And it was very much, oh, that's interesting. And I think me and a few other people, a few companies all started building our own things and we were learning and iterating from each other. And so it was very much like a small closed off group at that point. And then I think some vendors started entering the market, but back in those days, it was very much like a collection of hacked Python scripts to just check what OS version you're using. Like it didn't really work in how you wanted it to be. I think only today would I say in the last 2 years, maybe that vendors have caught up. Like if you had asked me 2 years ago on what tool should I use, I'd say don't use a tool, build it yourself if you have the resources. If you ask me today, I would say, please do use a vendor. Like don't build this yourself because having gone through that, it's a lot of work. It's a lot of effort. It's a lot of coding, a lot of maintenance. And I think that the vendors do pretty good. And it depends what you want. There are cloud first vendors like the Optas and the Cloudflares of the world where they don't give you zero trust out of the box, but it's pretty close. Same with Microsoft as well. I actually think if you are in Azure using Microsoft like Windows devices and your 365 and all of that, Microsoft is probably the best solution for you because it's so easy to deploy. It's just so easy because they just control the entire ecosystem. Whereas I think a lot of people approached it from the hey, we already have a network and we want to get to zero trust. We've got all this on-prem stuff. So maybe let's use the more like Zscalers, Palo Altos, do the SASE thing. And maybe that's good enough for us, or maybe we'll use that to kickstart us and keep us going until we can move all that stuff out if we ever do that. So yeah, I guess that's my thoughts. There's a lot there to digest, I think.
Yeah, I think that's a fair hot take. And we were laughing because you mentioned a very good point about VPNs, not zero trust. And that's also something that Elliot for the last 2.5, 3 years now has been nonstop on social media. Every time someone says, oh yeah, for your zero trust policy, just implement this VPN. And then Elliot is, I think he's got this on hot search or something on LinkedIn. I don't know, but I see my feed come across. Someone mentioned VPN and zero trust and Elliot's right there going, no, I don't think you understand what this word means.
But it's very common, and this is maybe a tangent, but a lot of zero trust things today, they have an agent that you install on your device and it's like a VPN client and use the whole secure web gateway thing where you have an IP address and then you connect into those services and you're essentially doing IP allow listing. And part of me just goes, oh, like this is this hurts. This is like going back to how we used to do things 10 years ago. And I know there's very valid use cases for doing that. If you need to protect APIs where they don't have SAML, probably the only way, really, or the only good way I've seen. But yeah, it's something I don't want to do unless I have to, because I'm always like, we should be better than this, but there is nothing better yet.
Yeah, that makes total sense. So on some of those notes with the tech stack and the growth, so I think that's actually maybe a good transition. So we talk about tech and the failures, we talk about VPNs and the failures. So from a starter package perspective, we started alluding to this before we went down the toilet paper route. But when we're getting started, so we mentioned small company versus big company. And once again, your background, small companies, big companies as well. What's been maybe some of the bigger hurdles for you at either stage, or have they been comparable when you've been getting started, irrespective of scale of the company, when you've been working into this mentality? Or have there been substantially different hurdles based off of scale that you've had to really consider when going forward?
Absolutely. Like for smaller companies is resources and money. So for example, with zero trust setups, you generally need the idea of corporate devices, right? Not BYOD. So you're going to have to convince a CEO or a CFO, we need to buy 100, 200, 500 books or Windows machines or whatever that they're going to use. And usually that difficult part, I find it's we need to pay for something that already works, but it's a security thing. And I think that you can point to a lot of breaches in the past and you can say, this is what can happen. It's really getting that point across. I do think it's a lot easier though. Like if you are a single IT and security person in a company of 100 that only has Azure, I'll just use an example, but any tool would work. You could probably do this in a week, to be honest with you. Like it does not take that long. You have your devices already set. You've got an MDM. You may not be managing them perfectly, and you've got the cloud stuff. You can turn on Azure Conditional Access. You can deploy certificates to those devices. Off you go. It's when you get into those larger companies where I think the complexity and the tech debt tend to be big problems. So the more on-prem and office stuff you have, the harder it's going to be. The more distributed your developers are, if you are a developer shop, makes it harder. So if you have different squads and I don't know, maybe some code on GCP and some in AWS and some are using Cloudflare workers or something, that's three different platforms. And if you have Windows and Mac and Linux and all of these other things, now you've got three MDMs that you've got to support. And so you're ending up doing the same work like 20 times because of all of these different groups that you need to deal with. And so this may be spicy, but I think that you need to bring those groups down. And so if you have 10 Linux users in your company, do they really need to be using Linux? Can you just get rid of it? Because it's going to cause you a whole bunch of problems just supporting those 10 devices. And so I do recommend as much as possible, simplify. And people will scream and shout and say, no, we need these things. Just look at it from a business perspective. Do you need to test for Linux users? Maybe you build some software for Linux and Windows and Mac. Yeah, you probably do need those machines. Maybe you can move them to the cloud and you can isolate them and have these sandboxed isolated workloads. And that may be a better approach than supporting those devices. I think there's one more problem that I find. And again, I think it's a bit of a spicy one, but it's politics, of course. It depends on the company in question. I would say in my experience in the past, I've had very little issues personally, but I have heard of teams having big problems. I don't want to call out network teams because I have friends in network teams. I love my network teams, but I've heard of people having experiences where you're saying, we don't need the VPN anymore. We're going to use this other thing. And then they get protective because that's the thing they're managing today. And it's not like we're replacing the VPN and you don't have a job. We're changing the way it works. You're going to have to maybe change how you operate. Like maybe you are managing less complex firewalls and on-prem networks and you'll be moving to more cloud, agent support, more desktop stuff. If you've been doing networks for 20 years, maybe you don't want to do that or whatnot. So I do think you need to bring those teams on board and get them in and get everyone aligned to the same goal, or you're going to end up getting bogged down in politics and people not doing what you need them to do and all of that stuff. And like I said, I think that's Yeah. I don't want to say that's more common in traditional companies, but the larger things are, the more distributed they are, the more likely.
Yeah, politics are great, ain't they? So that does bring to mind a wonderful question Elliot had on the primer sheet. I think this is a really good question. So normally I don't ask Elliot's questions on the primer sheets. I just go through them, and if he likes them, he can come back to them. No, I'm kidding. That makes it. So we talk about, obviously, implementation strategies, some of the hurdles there, like you just mentioned, people, person problems, stuff like that, tech stack stuff. By the way, you're not getting rid of my Linux, but you can try. The one thing here I think is neat to think about is the awareness factor of when you think your company's ready for this. And in reality, I think the answer is everyone's ready for it. They just need to realize it. But do you think there's some kind of key elements within these companies you've been at before that were legitimate tippers for, hey, we need to be serious about this and go forth with this zero trust mentality? Or were there opportunities there where you're like, maybe not today, but give yourself 6 months because you do really need to have X, Y, and Z beforehand kind of stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a hard one, to be honest. Like, I do think you may occasionally come across something where you're like, we can't do this now, or it's not a priority now. I do think you should be quite critical on what those things are. Like, just because someone says, you can't take away my Linux machine, don't just say, okay, then I'll... whatever. I think you need to get it from a business perspective. And that's where leadership support comes in, right? If you have a head of engineering who knows the ins and outs of this, so maybe they could say, oh, we actually don't need that. Like, we can move that to AWS or something. They can use VMs or something else. Then that's probably the approach you're going to take. If you don't have leadership support and they're like, oh no, like, we love our engineers, obviously, but maybe they're not willing to make those trade-offs, you probably will struggle. And that's where I see a lot of these people like start and then get bogged down halfway, and they get bogged down in things like this. I do think you can make trade-offs though, right? I have seen people in the past just exclude certain devices from their zero trust checks, for example. If you're coming from a macOS device, you need a certificate, you need to be on the latest version, you need to have antivirus and stuff. When it comes to something like, you might say, okay, we don't have an MDM, but maybe we can install the certificates manually. Maybe the numbers are small enough. Maybe we can just have EDR in place and that will get us 80% of where we need. At least we've got data on those machines then. Maybe we can't control the exact operating system versions, but we can at least see, we can report on it. But like I say, I think I wouldn't take this approach without a little pushback, but if there was significant pushback or there was good business reason to do this, then that's something I would consider.
So another quick curiosity question. When we think about cost benefits, obviously we know, we all agree, cost benefit analysis is ridiculously good. The ROI on this involvement and effort is always on the plus side when done appropriately. However, Kyle, when you've gone in and you've looked at current security stacks and dollars, and you've looked at what you're having to either rip and replace, update, change, manage, add to, are you looking at a net increase of a substantial portion for implementation sometimes, or are you looking at a wash? And to your point, you already mentioned that if you're in certain cloud solutions, it's probably a flick of a button in some cases today, right? And not necessarily cost, it's just you changing a little bit how you do business. But in the grand scheme of things, when you go through these process flows, is it a net wash? Is it typically a little bit more on the cost center side of the house as a whole? Or are we able to sometimes maybe even save a buck or two because we're implementing better tooling and streamlining that tooling to more effect?
Yeah, it's honestly going to depend on the company and stuff like that, right? I do think these things tend to cost a little more compared to your existing tooling that you have in place. Does it cost more when you factor in incidents that you're having and things like that, and the cost of people and the response and the time? Hard to verify this. It's going to depend on all sorts of things. But I would probably argue that you should try and do that as best you can. And I'll go into a very key example, I think. So when it comes to zero trust, this is simplifying it a bit, but we tend to think of identity, devices, and SaaS, I think, or apps, I would say. People who have network stuff. Maybe network would be its own pillar for those. Identity is, I don't want to call one out as my favorite or most important, but it's identity. Like, when you look at most breaches that happen in real life that have caused stuff, it's stuff like phishing, it's credential stuffing, it's identity-based attacks, right? And so I do think when you are building your MVP, identity should be the first thing you do, and then everything else. And identity and SaaS and networks are tied together because you need to prevent access to these things using the identity. But it is something where I think that it is worth the investment. And like I say, to dive a bit deeper, something like YubiKeys, if you can roll out YubiKeys or security keys in general, that's going to cost you a lot of money. They cost, depends on the type, but anywhere between 20 and 60 bucks per person. And then you're going to have breakages. You're going to have contractors that maybe only have them for a while before they send them back and stuff. It's going to add some overhead to IT to send these out and whatnot. But it's going to just almost entirely stop phishing in your enterprise. So is that cost worth the trade-off for you? Like, how many incidents have you had in the past year, 2 years, 3 years that have been a result of this? And could also start thinking then about our detection and response team have been dealing with all of this stuff, and they've been building alerts in Okta and Microsoft for phishing and all of this kind of stuff. They can now maybe focus their efforts on detecting malware and other stuff. And then you're getting more value out of that team because they no longer have to worry about this stuff as much. Of course, there's still going to be a few things, but it's not going to be as critical.
That makes sense. I'm not going to lie. I know YubiKey helps obviously with the phishing piece, but because of my background, my response to helping that poor employee who's clicking yes, no, maybe, and all the email crap that comes in is to get them an orchestration device. But the hilarity being the cost of that tool, depending on the scale of your organization, is probably about the same as what it would be depending on how large. Like, you're in a couple of thousand employee-based orchestration tool, just to help do that one thing is probably going to cost the same as if you did put up YubiKeys for everybody.
Can do passkeys as well today on mobile, and they aren't as good as these single device passkeys like security keys. There's still ways they can be compromised. Like, you can compromise the 1Password account or the Google account that those keys are stored in. They're better than push. They're better than authentication apps. They're certainly better than SMS and call. And so that's something you might also want to consider, because that's much easier and much cheaper to implement than buying a $60 security key for every single person in the company.
Yes. Oh, he knows a guy, though. He can get him on discount. Now, I would love to see a completely FIDO compliant only environment in that same sense. Yeah. Talk about GovSpace and tokenized accesses and things like that. Yeah. Exactly. With his YubiKey. Coming from the government side, I think it's fun to talk about this in the private sector, when, not saying that the government here in the States got it right in the 90s, early 2000s, but the concepts that we're playing with today, even though they're being defined as what they are, like PKI and your CAC. We had chip-enabled physical security card, right? And then you had an RSA token on top of that you walked around with every time you were in a security. So you had two out of the three right off the bat that you needed for authentication. Good luck. And when they implemented the CAC procedures alone, they implemented that, like YubiKey, they implemented that because of phishing issues and nail forwarding issues, all this other fun stuff. And then things tanked overnight when they went global with that policy. That being said, so thinking about scalable economics, thinking about growth and cost benefit analysis, I think that's a really good take. I don't think we've really ever asked anybody kind of their thoughts on the value props outright on this. We also have only had a couple of people that I think that have done this from a practical app perspective more than at one facility. There's a lot of people we've talked to that have done this, and they've done really large journeys, and they've done a couple of focused journeys, but we haven't had someone that's done it multiple times, I think, really. So it's neat perspective-wise from you to go down that rabbit hole with this. So I appreciate that. I've got maybe one more thought here, and it's back to the journey-based perspective. When you're going down the rabbit hole from your side of the house, is Zero Trust a never-ending journey, or is it in the sense of, I know we've got to update things. Stuff obviously has to update. You got to do routine stuff. But is it really a never-ending journey where once you set this 3-year plan, it's really a 20-year plan until you quit the company or die? Or is it can you truly have an end state where it is more maintenance than implementation at some point in your livelihood?
It's a really good question. I don't think it's been around long enough for anyone to really truly say, we're done. We got this in the bag. Like every system I've built in the past, like I still speak to the old teams, they are still carrying on with improvements and things like that. Like there is always more to do. I think when you look at it, a lot of it would probably just be like new technology that needs to come in and stuff like that. We're giving everyone Chromebooks now, and so we need to support that. And so that's another thing that we have to build out, or we've got new apps coming in constantly. But I do think that you will probably have an initial sprint, and then you'll get to the place that you need to be, and then you'll maybe reduce your headcount by, I don't know, anywhere between 10% and 10%, and then you'll roll into a more maintenance mode. I do find that kind of sad, almost in a way. I do find that sort of zero trust, if I was to, like I say, slice and dice it, you've got your really basic policy-based decisions where you're saying, is this user on corporate devices? Do they have the latest version, et cetera? And then going beyond that, there's this idea of contextual access and thinking more about all the data in all the systems we have these days. So you can say, Elliot has absolutely never gone and accessed Snowflake in his life, and now suddenly he's in there every day downloading all of our data. Maybe that's a bad thing. He shouldn't access. And of course, that's beyond making sure people only have access to do the things they need. But there's certainly some interesting things from like a customer perspective as well. So thinking like, maybe I'm a support engineer and I support customer A and B, but then suddenly I go and access C's data using like an emergency token or something because someone was out. Was that verified? And so I think that's probably where we're going now. I feel like that's definitely buzzwordy, just saying, yeah, we're going to use data to make it better. But that is what I see a lot of people working on today. And I find that the sort of the return on investment when you get into that is maybe lower, getting more into detections and alerting more so than prevention. But I don't think anyone apart from maybe Google and a few others have really started looking into stuff. Actually, there's one other thing where for the people who do have networks, like I say, we truly have zero trust yet, right? Because you still have a segmented network where there's some inherent access and you just try and make these as small as you can. The idea of having a one-to-one device to connection mapping rather than having the micro segmentations could be interesting. Google have been working on something in that. They released another white paper in their BeyondCorp series, I think last year or maybe the year before. Really interesting, worth taking a read, seeing what they're doing. I would love to see the network vendors start thinking about it this way, but they are not financially motivated, let's say, to do something like that, I think. So I think it'll probably be a startup or something that starts thinking about that.
That makes sense. Can't just jump on the Eagle and ride it all the way to Mount Doom. Easy things to do. No, I appreciate it. That's solid insight. So I think the one last piece for me in this, for my brain at the moment, and then I'll maybe throw it back over to Elliot. From an adoption perspective, getting started, just kind of fair reminders for everyone. You know, we're not necessarily saying don't waste your time on a three-year plan. We're also not saying wait for the three-year plan to be finalized to start on what you could be doing today impact. Right. Everybody's journey is obviously a little different. Everybody's got to find a place to start. And then end of the day, just try to figure out what chunks you can bite off of now to show some kind of benefit. And to your point, focusing on the identity access piece, I think that's a really good call out. I think those are typically easier wins to figure out who and what's logging into what, and why, and then set up your policies around that. But on the, you alluded to this a minute ago, enterprise versus SaaS side of the house. And one last quick question to grow on that. From an enterprise model perspective, in-house, on-prem, difficulties versus SaaS-based solutioning in your mind. What is there echelons of difficulty or should, grant, it's going to be similar policy and procedures, but implementation and impact. Do you see that being more difficult left, right of that vertical as a whole? I'm asking a lot of Elliot questions today. I didn't even look at that document for more than 30 seconds. I know this is a question on that document.
I'm
very proud of myself right now, if that is. I drank my brain juice this morning. But yeah, so left, right of the vertical, back on point. The road goes on. But when you're looking at it, enterprise versus SaaS, implementing either side of the vertical, is it easier to control your SaaS stuff versus the stuff that's on the enterprise layer?
Yeah, just start with SaaS, is what I'll say. If you have both, just start with SaaS. And going MVP as well, you know, you've probably got really sensitive stuff on-prem, especially if you're a bank. You're probably talking mainframes. I don't know, have the Excel spreadsheets that keep our financial systems together on there or something. But it's just harder. And I think a lot of those systems are probably written in COBOL and all sorts of wild stuff. And I talked about this in my blog on like writing an MVP, but you've got a few different approaches. You can decide to like YOLO, all in on SaaS, try and move to cloud, whether it's a lift and shift or a rebuild or whatever. It's like seeing how many services that you've got, how painful it would be to move them. Do you have the experience required? If you can't do that, just do SASE, right? Like just whack some sort of proxy in front of them. It'll get them into your zero trust stuff. So you're at least doing checks. It's not perfect because, like I said, there's still a network behind it, even if you don't want to think of that. And so someone could compromise something around there. But realistically, what's going to happen is a device is going to get compromised with something like malware, and then they're going to pivot in there instead. As long as you're doing as good device checks as you can somehow, that's fine. This will hurt you speaking about this actually, Elliot, but previous place where I had a friend who worked, I heard that essentially what they did was they built zero trust for their SaaS stuff, and then they kept the VPN for their on-prem stuff, and they just rebuilt all the same checks in there, which we had the same certificate checks on the VPN, the same SaaS check or the same sort of device checks, all of that. And they just had their network off. And so me, 30% company or something needed to access anything on there. It's small, but it's less, right? It's 100%. It's not 100% of people using the VPN. And don't let perfection be the enemy is what I'm saying, I guess, here.
That's all I got. Well, I guess one more little anecdote. The road goes ever on and on down from the door and all that jazz. So get started, get moving, and do something productive. We did make a warning at the start of this episode, and I've only dropped twice. And what we get when we get someone in Kiwi land.
You didn't think I was going to let it end there, right? Instead of the usual, I've got one big last question that could spin off into a 30 other directions. I want to be really annoying and cheesy. So, Kane, we're going to start with you. I've got one question. What is the name of Gandalf's horse? And I can give you options if we need.
I can tell you exactly right.
Yeah, now. I know you know. Yeah. But
that is actually one that I don't know. Maybe Perfect. If you All give right. me a few options, I might be able to guess.
I'd look through like 30 of like questions. Like, yeah, you can kind of hear that. Mr. Oates, Lil Jimbo, Knight Rider, or Shadowfax?
It's Shadowfax, I think, right?
Yeah. Is that right, Neil?
That is very accurate. Lord of all horses.
It was down there somewhere in the back of the
brain. And just to be politically correct here, he is not Gandalf's horse. Shadowfax allows Gandalf to partake in his presence. Shadowfax is officially owned by no man or Meyer or Ishtari. So anyway, there we go. That's all right, man.
This is totally off topic. I recently went to the Weta workshop here in Auckland with people who built a lot of the designs and stuff behind the movies. And at the end of it, there's like the typical shot, right? And usually I just walk through, I don't care at all. But there was a huge one of like a huge replica of Sauron's mace, and it was like $700 or something like that. And it was huge. And I was like, it'd be great to have that on the wall, wouldn't it?
yeah, it would. Oh, wow.
Home defense as well. It's dual use.
That's a write-off in some places. I'm just going to say, yeah.
I will Security. Tell you, there's people on Etsy that have also built them, because last Halloween I went to Sauron. I had the drywall stilts and went, which also was a terrible idea, and I also ran like 80 miles the day before it, so I was trying to not deny. Got it right over there. I'm not going to reach over and grab it since mostly everyone listens, but I don't know. I got some dude to build like a really cool Sauron out of some foam core. Yeah, so just saying, there's some pretty good replicas of the maze on Etsy. Probably 500 though.
And I love it. Yeah. And for those actually still listening at this point in the record, while the movies and what Peter Jackson did are phenomenal and should never be remade for what they were, the books are obviously always better. Yeah, we'll leave it at that. But
And no, Sheila, hold on. I want to pick a scam. What are your thoughts on the Amazon version?
I cannot use the words.
Got it.
To all describe right. it here.
Finished that before.
Mostly PG.
they spent a lot of money. And it looks pretty. I'll leave it there. But with that means we are at the end of this episode. I have taken us off track. Unlike that, that's your role, Neil. So Kane, thank you so much for being here. We really appreciate your perspective. I also will recommend, if you all do not follow Kane on LinkedIn, that is where I ran into his post about Zero Trust MVPs. And he tends to share some pretty smart, intelligent things that I think a lot of us can grow and learn from. So go stalk him on there, follow him, whatever. But there's some good stuff there. Point in that direction. Anyways, that said, Kane, thank you again. We really appreciate you being here. Help us walk through this. This is a perspective and a area of focus we just haven't covered before. So it is always really neat to be able to see that there's just a million different ways to pull this conversation apart.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. It's been great.
Thank you for joining AZT, an independent series. Your hosts have been Elliot Volkman and Neil Dennis. To learn more about Zero Trust, go to adoptingzerotrust.com, subscribe to our newsletter, or join our Slack community. Viewpoints expressed during the show do not reflect the brands, employers, or companies of our hosts, guests, or potential sponsors.